we were pleased to welcome Doug Morgan, who's a member of the SWP in Birmingham. He's going to speak about why Trotsky matters today.
Hi, yeah, well, mate, thanks for letting me introduce the meeting tonight. And the meeting's on Trotsky, really. Why does Trotsky matter today? And I know you had a meeting recently around the Russian Revolution, I think. And to be honest, we could just spend the next 20, 25 minutes, half an hour just talking about that. And that wouldn't be a bad thing to do at all. But there's a lot more to Trotsky than that. So I'm going to try and go through some of the key parts of Trotsky's contribution to Marxism. Obviously, we, if you look at the world we live in, there's environmental destruction, there's poverty in a world of plenty, we've got wars, we've got famines, we've got repression and more, and at the same time, we have glimpses of resistance to it. Most certainly we could see through the strikes that have taken place in Britain, but this resistance takes place across the world. So given that, we look at it as being a class contribution, and how do contending classes compete against each other? Why is there any point looking at individuals or particular actors or actions from the past? And I think that there's good reasons to look at Trotsky and to his contribution. And to be honest, we could look at any bits of Trotsky's achievements, any one of which any of us in this room now would go, yeah, I wouldn't mind being the person who did that, right? Any bits of his contributions were immense, you know. By anyone's standards, the guy was a giant, really. At the age of 26, he led 200,000 workers in the Petrograd Soviet in the 1905 revolution, a sort of great dress rehearsal for the 1917 revolutions that were to come. And he described the excitement of 1905 as being revolution appears as utter madness only to those who it sweeps and dies and overthrows. To us, it was different. We were in our own element, albeit a very stormy one. Trotsky was a key leader of the October 1917 Russian Revolution. For the Bolsheviks, he led the Red Army against counter-revolution and against more than a dozen invading armies, as well as trying to both expand the revolutionary upsurge following the First World War. He was a key voice in the arguments to resist the rise of Hitler. He organised against Stalinism as an attempt to try to both keep the revolutionary flame alive and to try and centre workers at the centre of struggle. And on top of this, he was one of the most effective orators, theoreticians, historian, a journalist, a writer on everything from poetry to terrorism, art to trade union bureaucracy and more. And if you think of revolutionaries as being a bit boring, then obviously we need to think again. Lev Davidovich Bronstein, he was his name. And he coined the name Trotsky from one of his jailers, and it was actually tried to avoid persecution, but he was born in a small Ukrainian village in 1879 to relatively well-off Jewish peasants. Ukraine was part of the huge Russian Empire. There's one or two bits in the news recently about Russia's relationship with Ukraine and all the rest of it, and then it was part of the huge Russian Empire, which was a repressive society dominated by the Tsar and the Orthodox Church. Serfdom had only just been abolished less than 20 years before, effectively tying people to the land and whatever it is the landlord wanted them to do, the aristocracy, whatever they wanted them to do. It had only been abolished 20 years before, and most of Russia was rural and based on peasant farming. There was a small and growing industry in the towns, but mainly it was quite rural. Russia was a country where anti-Semitism was encouraged by the state. Jewish people were barred from settling or owning land in many parts of Russia, which is why Trotsky's family ended up in the Ukraine. And there was resistance to this, most notably at the time by the Narodniks, which means the friends of the people, who looked towards the traditions of peasant village life as an alternative to the horrors of capitalism that they could begin to see around them, and into the horrors of life, really. But the attempts by the Narodniks to try and live amongst the peasantry as a way of trying to get them to rebel failed, and they turned increasingly to conspiratorial and violent acts to effect change, which included assassinating the Tsar. And although rather than fermenting resistance, which is what they thought would happen, actually all it served to do was bring more repression from the state. The gap between what the Narodniks wanted and what the people wanted at the time was just far, far too big, and what they were encouraging people to do just seemed ludicrous to quite a lot of people. Nevertheless, though, capitalism does have a bit of a habit of forcing rebellion. And in the mid-1890s, there's a rising wave of resistance and defiance. In 1896, saw hundreds of students refuse to swear allegiance to the new Tsar. And 30,000 workers go out on strike in the capital of St. Petersburg. And this was the first strike wave on that scale that Russia had seen. And what it began to do was to bring a new force into the scene of struggle, that being the urban working class. And it's within this context that Trotsky, now a 17-year-old student, joined a circle of revolutionaries, actually based around the hut of a gardener. And initially, Trotsky described himself as a Narodnik. You know, he was a radical, and that's who the radicals were before embracing Marxism. Shortly after. And for him, what was key with Marxism, it should be key for all of us, but what was particularly important was that the working class was the key potential revolutionary class. It was the gravedigger of capitalism, and that the working class would need to do it. They would need to overthrow the system in order to change itself and begin the process of moving towards socialism. Very much the Marxist idea of the emancipation of the working class is the act of the working class, and this was something that stayed with Trotsky throughout. Trotsky's dad, although it sometimes liked rebellion, and I'll come on to that, didn't quite like this. He didn't like Trotsky hanging around with the revolutionaries, and he said wanted him to be an engineer or a mathematician instead, and not thrown into prison, a crucial thing, not being sent to prison. But, you know, as 17-year-olds might do, Trotsky said, no, stuff that, I'm gonna be a revolutionary, and he basically cut himself off financially from his parents. And that was really his stepping stone into becoming a revolutionary. Now, he wouldn't have described himself as being particularly political growing up. You read My Life. Trotsky's book here. It's a really good read. It's a cracking read. There's loads of good stuff in it, and it sort of complements lots of his other books. But he wouldn't describe himself as a revolutionary growing up. What seems to be interesting, though, I mean, obviously Trotsky's wrote the book himself, so you know there's a little bit of license here in how he describes how he grows up. But what he does tend to point to is constantly learning lessons. Okay. And we'll slightly digress here, but I think it's an important bit, you know, to where Trotsky talks about one of his first acts of rebellion, and that being in the second grade of school, where he was part of organising a concert against a racist teacher, Bernand, who picked on German students. And Trotsky describes this as such, that what he was going to do was to give a concert meant to accompany the steps of the teacher while he was leaving the classroom with a howling sound made with a closed mouth, so that one could not tell who was actually doing it. Once or twice Bernand got it, but in a mild and considerably muffled form, as he was quite feared. This time, however, we mastered all our courage. The moment the Frenchman, he was actually Swiss, but anyway, they called him the Frenchman. The moment the Frenchman put the school journal under his arm, there came from the extreme flank a howl which spread in a rolling wave to the desk in front. I, for my part, did what I could. Bernand, who had already stepped through the door, instantly turned back and stood in the middle of the room, face to face with his enemies, his face pale green and his eyes darting fire, but without uttering a word. After staring at us for half a minute, Bernand turned to the door in such a fury that the tails of his coat blew out like sails. See, Trotsky's got a real way with words here. The Frenchman was accompanied this time by a unanimous and enthusiastic howl which followed him far down the corridor. Okay, so Trotsky was part of organising resistance and worked out that it wasn't good enough to just do it on your own. You had to do it with other people. But Trotsky also learns a lesson from this. So from this, as well as beginning to understand the power of collective action, that bullies, bigots, and those in authority only get away with what the majority allow them to get away with, he also began to learn lessons in what damages class cohesion. In response to the act against the teacher, Trotsky was suspended after some of the pupils dogged him in. Okay, and Trotsky continues, "Such, one might say, was the first political test I underwent. These were the groups that resulted from the episode. The tale bearers and the envious at one pole, the sort of scabs, the frank, courageous boys at the other, who refused to dob anyone in, this sort of us revolutionaries there, and the neutral, vacillating mass in the middle. These three groups never quite disappeared, even during the years that followed. I met them again and again in my life in the most varied circumstances." So Trotsky learns all the time. That's what seems to come across. Okay, and he's applying this in later years to class struggle. Okay, so again, could talk about the Russian Revolution, could talk about the fact that in a country as anti-Semitic as Russia, a Jewish person was leading Soviets. So could do that, but again, there's more to Trotsky than that. So I'm going to go through five elements that I think Trotsky brings to us and to classical Marxist thought. Okay, the first is his theory of permanent revolution, and some of this may seem more obvious to us now, but back then, when the vast majority of the world was made up of peasant and semi-feudal states, it was less so. Okay, so the idea of permanent revolution in a succinct way was a break then for most Marxist thinkers, including to some extent Lenin, and the prevailing view was that in order to get to socialism, it needed to go through bourgeois capitalist revolutions in order to build up capitalist forces of production, to make certain we've got a world of plenty, if you like, to make certain we've got people who are removed, if you like, from the lands to an extent, and can see their lot with others, so we had to build up the capitalist forces of production, and then after we built up capitalist forces of production, you can have further revolutions that move on towards socialism. Okay, and so to many revolutionaries at the time, the role of workers was then to push the bourgeoisie, the capitalists, to get rid of feudal monarchies, and what it would mean would be an alliance really with liberal capitalists. Now Lenin disagreed with that alliance, actually, instead thinking that workers should be at the fore of the movement to get rid of the monarchs, essentially to try as much as being charged, but still expected that there would be a limit in less capitalistic nations, and that it would only really extend to the bourgeois revolution. Trotsky argued that instead capitalism was an international system, not new to people, but he really emphasised the internationalism of this, one of combined and uneven development, which meant productive forces can be both copied from across the world, but also that assistance to revolts can be international. And what had shaken the Russian ruling class and given Russia a glimmer of hope, a glimmer of democracy, was the struggles by workers in Petrograd in 1905. Not the dissipated struggles, and it would have been many of them, by peasants over time. It's workers using that potential might, that economic might, to go over the heads of the capitalist class, okay, as part of pushing for revolutions elsewhere, and this, as I say, could be the key mover to socialism. And again, Lenin got some of this. You know, when he looked at the Russian bourgeoisie in 1905, he could see how timid they were, how unprepared they were to really challenge. But again, couldn't see it going beyond there. For Trotsky, the idea of permanent revolution, of pushing, the spread of revolution was key. And that sort of goes to the next bit of Trotsky, which is his internationalism. And Trotsky's internationalism was incredible. When everyone, it would have said, yes, of course, we need to be international. We need to do this. Trotsky really tried to foment revolution in countries. Some of them, I can't think they actually even got to visit, but was constantly writing, constantly seeking information from around the world to see if there was ways to try to help foment burgeoning working class movements and rebellions. And he wrote on many countries, on Britain, Germany, Spain, China, Belgium, Turkey, Austria, France, Italy, pardon me, India, Switzerland, the United States, and more. Some of the countries he'd got to live in, some of them he was exiled in, some of them he was chucked out of, but he constantly trying to ferment the idea of struggle elsewhere. I mean, when you look at Trotsky's collective works, especially considering that this was someone who spent a huge amount of his time in prison, a huge amount of his time on the run, huge amount of his time being deeply involved in movements, the collective works are just incredible. Okay, so the internationalism for him and the arguments that we have to keep pushing internationally were crucial. The next element I'm going to just briefly touch on is the United Front. And for Trotsky, looking at the United Front, and again, this is something I think to us is obvious. You unite with people who are progressive, but to the right of you, partly because, not because you necessarily want to capture their leaders so that their leaders all become good revolutionaries, but because you can see that there is a force that they command, they have influence over, workers they have influence over, and together, if you work collectively, you can make progressive actions in order to effect change or stop reaction. And for Trotsky, a central part of looking at the United Front was to try to resist the rise of fascism, the rise of fascism in Europe, and to try to argue harshly and hard with revolutionaries, say you've got to unite with the people that fascism would try to attack. Now, some of this stuff Trotsky learned in struggle, actually, from the General Kornilov affair and the attempts in Russia during the revolutionary year 1917, attempts to try to smash the revolution and bring in an old guard. I think it was Lenin who said it. It may have been Trotsky who said that if fascism would have been a Russian word, if that reaction was able to win there, the Bolsheviks in 1917 were able to repel the reaction and attempts to smash the revolutions in 1917, and mainly just by being incredibly organised. I don't think there were any shots fired at all, mainly just by being incredibly organised. Okay, Trotsky had learned from that in saying that you've got to unite with people, even if there are people who you might feel are your enemies, but if they command a progressive section of the working class, you've got to try to link with them. And so what we might do around stand up to racism and linking with people in the Labour Party or unions and all the rest of it. Obviously, we're part of trade unions, but we're trying to pull wider forces. When Trotsky wrote that, though, I think you have to imagine that he's writing this to revolutionaries to say you've got to unite with the equivalent of the Labour Party in places like Germany. But the equivalent of the Labour Party in places like Germany had snuffed out a revolution, were part of killing revolutionary leaders and leaders on the ground. You know, so this was a massive thing. But Trotsky correctly analysed what fascism really was, and that was a crucial part of looking at United Front. And this little book, I don't know if you can see it, Fascism, Stalinism, United Front, is a crucial read to develop that. Within that book and others, you know, Trotsky, another huge contribution, fourth thing really, was the idea that we need that revolutionaries and the workers' movement needed to break with the idea that Russia was still a successful revolutionary state. You know, by the 1920s, you know, mid-1920s onwards, Trotsky's asking massive questions about what's taking place as Stalin begins to take control with dictatorship in Russia and how that would relate elsewhere. And although we wouldn't necessarily agree on what Trotsky's analysis was, and I'll come on that briefly in a minute, although we wouldn't necessarily agree on what Trotsky's analysis was on Russia, it was important that there were revolutionaries beginning to say something's wrong here, not just for the audience in Russia, which it became increasingly impossible for Trotsky to try to organise in because of the purges and the the dictatorial means that Stalin really represented, but also to say to revolutionaries and workers' movements across the world, something's not right. And that must have been an incredibly difficult thing for someone like Trotsky to have done, you know, somebody who'd helped lead the revolution, you know, who was crucial in the October Revolution in particular, in Russia, to begin to say that there's a problem. For him, he looked at it as being, you know, sort of a bureaucratic workers' state. Workers were still somewhere in charge, but it was really run by a bureaucracy. Now, we would argue against that. We would argue against that. Sorry, I've got my kids coming into the room. They obviously want to know about Trotsky too. We would argue that it wasn't actually. It ceased being a workers' state. You know, really, you know, from the sort of the mid-1920s onwards, as a result of the crushing civil war and a failure of revolution to spread, which of course could be many more meetings for us. You know, that there's a lot we could look into that, but nevertheless, it was still important that Trotsky was trying to signal something's not right, something has gone wrong. And when you look at that, the impact of that, of not heeding this message, you know, how the Communist Party in Spain helped to sell out, you know, the sort of revolutionary movements to stop Mussolini, and these sort of arguments could be writ large in a whole number of countries, especially across Europe. You know, the extent of at that point the Communist Party becoming really a tool of Stalin rather than a tool of trying to foment revolution elsewhere. You know, you know Trotsky's contribution here, you know, I don't think we should overlook. The last bit I want to come to, and I realize I've been speaking a long time, is Trotsky the party builder. And I don't think this is something that we necessarily look to Trotsky. You know, we look especially to Lenin and the idea of a democratic centralist organization. And certainly that was a big argument, that Lenin and the Leninist model of how to organize is a crucial way in how revolutionaries still need to organize today. But it'd be wrong to sort of say that Trotsky didn't really do that stuff, you know, that Trotsky, you know, Trotsky was just there for the big moments, you know, and was, you know, very proud of his stances here and there, and that's it. It'd be wrong to do that. When the Bolsheviks and the Mensheviks split in the early 20th century, and they split over what was a member, really, what type of organisation do you have, and who you should open the party up to. When they split, Trotsky initially went with the Mensheviks, although he didn't stay with the Mensheviks, partly because they disagreed so much with the idea of permanent revolution, which he'd come to a conclusion around 1905, 1906, you know, that this was the way we had to, the revolutionaries had to look on things. So Trotsky wasn't in the Mensheviks, he was sort of around his own organisation. In some respects, I think he sort of hoped that revolutionaries would all just come back together and it would be good. I don't think he quite understood what the split, the essence of the split was about. But then again, I don't even know if Lenin really got at that point precisely what the split would mean in that point. That would come out much clearer every time there was a big test on international issues, on war, on revolution, on how do we move forwards. The gulf between the Mensheviks and the Bolsheviks would widen even more. And, you know, when it came to the revolution in 1917, Trotsky was very clear that the Mensheviks represented really a regressive role within any movement, and for him, one of the things that he argued, you know, after the revolution, was that his biggest regret was not joining the Bolsheviks earlier, not being a central part of trying to look at the organisation of the party and being able to move on. And I've got some quotes here, but I'm a bit short on time, so I'm not going to go through them. But say a crucial thing for him was that the revolution needed a political organisation. I mean, he looked at different, you know, he said about himself, you know, without Trotsky, the revolutions in 1917 would have happened. Without Lenin and the Leninist model of party building, actually, we wouldn't have had the October Revolution. We'd have been snuffed out after the first revolution. So Trotsky devoted really the rest of his life to looking at how do you build organisations in different places around the world in different circumstances. And for him, he considered that, along with the fight, as part of the fight against Stalinism and to reclaim Marxism for working class people, he considered that his most crucial role in all of the struggles that he was involved in, in devoting his life to revolutionary change and revolutionary upsurge. And I think that for him, it comes back down to the idea that working class people can and will change the world around him. And there's a in the history of the Russian Revolution, this book here, which is an incredible piece of journalism and a historian that Trotsky was and all the rest of it. Incredible read about the Russian Revolution. We know how it ends. We know all the rest of it. But it's such an exciting read. And we'll just pick up one bit and then I'll finish there, which is that Trotsky quotes the former Tsarist General Zaleski, whose words sum up the ruling class's enduring hatred of workers and workers' confidence and as an aspect of the revolution. And he quotes General Zaleski as such: "Who would believe that the janitor or the watchman of the court building would suddenly become chief justice of the Court of Appeals, or the hospital orderly manager of the hospital?" And he goes on that line, how dare these people do this? And for Trotsky, that was it. That was it. The idea that ordinary people can change and shape the world around them and make a world that's worth living in, worth fighting for, that isn't based on the riches, the rich are getting rich and all of the horrors that they bring. For him, the idea that the ordinary person could at some point be part of making and shaping the world around them was crucial to what he gave his life to. And it's a crucial lesson that I think we should all learn and spread as far as we can.
That's brilliant. Thank you, Doug. You covered a heck of a lot there, so I'm sure people will have questions and comments that they want to make. So I'm going to open up for discussion as usual. If you want to speak, just raise your hand or your virtual hand if you can, if you're on Zoom, and I'll call people in. Barbara?
I just wanted to thank you for a very inspiring, enthusiastic talk. It was fantastic. And I always like people that number things. Things I might remember. It did raise the issue for me, I think, about the role of intellectuals and theorists in a party and in a revolution. Because, you can read very many books from professors in universities and other things where they're analyzing things, looking at history and data and everything else like that, but they may not be involved in practice. So, I think you think about the places like Romania and China where the intellectuals were vilified, when they had the revolution and stuff, and their role. And part of that may have been because obviously they were resistant to what was happening in the revolutions, a lot of them, or the failure of the revolutions and the swing to the right and autocracy, but also maybe because they weren't involved on the ground with what was going on. So if you wanted to comment on that, I would be interested, or anybody else in the room. But thank you, it was a really good talk.
Great, thanks Barbara. Jeannie, I don't know if you were pointing at somebody else. Go on, Jeannie.
Yeah, Doug, I've got a question for you, which is, would you say that the SWP is Trotskyist? Because it's not really a term of abuse you get much these days, but when I first joined the SWP, we were known as the Trots. And thought I'd better find out about Trotsky and decided I was proud to be a Trotskyist. But in reality, although Trotsky criticised what was happening in Russia, he never broke with the idea that in some way it was still a worker state right up until his death. It had bureaucratic degeneration, but what it needed really was a political revolution to get rid of Stalin, but that the basic economy, everything nationalized, meant it was still a worker state or socialist in some way. And really, our tradition that we stand in is not to agree with that, to say actually not only was a political revolution needed to get rid of Stalin, actually the working class were not owning and controlling what was produced in Russia. But the socialism in one country had created a system that had to compete, had to first of all build up the forces of industry and so forth in Russia, but then as a sort of unit had to compete on the world market, sell agricultural products in order to industrialize and so forth. And so it was actually what we call state capitalism. And so really it's a question of how much, obviously from what you're saying, Doug, you say we got to defend everything he stood for. But so I'm sort of asking the question of what people think, whether we think we're Trotskyists or not.
Thanks, Jeannie. Amanda?
Yeah. This may initially sound like a very unpopular view, but I see Trotskyism as a ship that's crashed. I see it as something that we need to learn from. I also see it as something that we've taken a lot from. So I would say the core, as far in answer to that genius question, I would say the core of Trotskyism, the ideals and the systems on how to work, I'd say we have taken as the SWP. So if I'm a Trotskyist, then yeah. I just think it's been modernised and given a bit more to make it viable. That's what we've done. What?
Thanks, Amanda. James?
Yeah, I don't disagree with that for Amanda at all. I think one of the things about how, as Marxists today, we relate to, if you want, our tradition, as it were, and Trotsky is part of our tradition, is that we rate critically, don't we? We're not worshippers of people who are infallible in any sort of way. And I think in all sorts of ways, you know, I think there are, you know, people like Lenin, Trotsky, Rosa Luxemburg, etc., all people who have played a fantastic contribution, both in terms of their engagement with revolutionary struggle, but also their development of revolutionary theory, which is huge. And but doesn't mean you can't engage critically with that and understand. And I think Trotskyism, our engagement with Trotskyism, is a to some extent a critical engagement. Having said that, I think the five things that outlines are key issues, all of which have a real relevance to us today. And I'm going to go through more, but I just want to talk about the idea of permanent revolution, really, and the significance of that. You think about, for example, the debates and arguments taking place in somewhere like Sudan in recent years, where there's been a mass revolutionary movement from below, popular mobilizations of the working class, and then a question arises about how does that movement relate to the entrenched power structures in Sudan, the military dictatorships, etc., and how does it relate to, if you want, attempts by various, I suppose you call them reformist groups, but other groups, elite groups in Sudan who are against the dictatorship that don't want to push through the revolution. And I think that's an important argument. And I think, you know, one of the reasons why we see in Sudan the awful situation we see now is because the revolution wasn't pushed through, as it were. It wasn't taken through. And that, I think, was a weakness. I'm just going to challenge it. So I think that is really, really important. The other thing I just want to say very briefly is that in terms of Trotsky's critique of Stalinist Russia and what took place in Russia, That was just an intellectual argument. We just passed the anniversary. 15th of August was the anniversary of Trotsky's assassination. So here's, you know, Trotsky is a person who's in exile. He was exiled from Soviet Russia in the late 1920s, was harried from country to country, ended up in Mexico, and on the 15th of August was assassinated by a GRU, a, you know, Soviet agent sent by Stalin to do it. Famous ice pick, you know, the ice pick chopped in the head with an ice pick and assassinated. So, and that was a direct hit job, if you want, by Stalin on Trotsky, because of what he represented, what the movement represented, and particularly, I think, what the idea of maintaining from the revolutionary traditions of 1917, which is what Trotsky was trying to do in very difficult circumstances in the 1930s and 1940s. This is a period where, for revolution, was extremely difficult, wasn't it? You had the rise of fascism, like Trotsky described fascism as a tank which would roll over and crush the skulls of the workers' movement, which it did, literally. It's not just metaphorically, literally did that. On the other hand, you have this Stalinist monolith in Russia, and the space for your independent working class, the idea of independent working class revolution was very, very small at that time. Trotsky was trying to keep that tradition alive, and to some extent, I think, you know, we're inheritors of that tradition. But as Amanda said, it's not a tradition we just look to, you know, blindly, but that we can sort of develop from and grow from. Now, people should read the stuff; it's fantastic. The little booklet on Trotsky there is a really good introduction. But some of the stuff that Doug's held up now, it's really worth. And also, Trotsky is such a good writer as well. He's not; he was a professional journalist. He worked as a journalist all his life. And that meant he was an extremely good writer. He's not, you know, some, you know, big left-wing thinkers and writers have got interesting things to say, but actually they're quite difficult to plough through. You know, it's quite hard work. Trotsky's a really, really good writer. It runs off the page. So people should read the stuff.
Thanks, James. So yeah, just to say, we have got copies of the Rebel's Guide to Trotsky on the bookstore, but also. Probably most of the other books that Doug has mentioned probably be available from Bookmarks if people want to read some of that for themselves. So anyone else want to come in to make a contribution or ask a question?
Yeah,
Andy?
Yeah, thanks. I thought it was a great introduction to Trotsky. I've read a small amount of his material. I've read more of Marx. You know, I'm very, very interested in Trotsky and what he's got to say. The little that I've read, he seems to be a brilliant writer. I was thinking of, sorry, was it Barbara's point? I wasn't 100% sure of what your point was, but I think that I got it regarding the role of intellectuals, and perhaps I misinterpreted it, but. Is it the argument as if they're like sort of superfluous or they don't really do a lot? Is that what you meant?
No, I think some people view that.
Right, because I was right. About to make a defense. Okay.
But I think that they're needed. If you're in the army and you're fighting counter-revolutionists, you don't have much time to think about on the front, you know, what actually the whole analysis of the situation is. Do you know what I mean? So I think they're necessary, but they have to be grounded on what's actually happening.
Right, okay.
You know, that was my point, really.
Okay, well, thanks for
clarifying. Because some people don't think intellectuals should be, you know.
Yeah, well, thanks for clarifying that, because then I was about to launch into a defence of intellectuals.
That's killed a lot of them.
Yeah, I mean,
you're still welcome to defend intellectuals, Andy.
Yeah, I'm an intellectual.
So I agree.
Yeah, but you know, I will. I'm still, because I think that it's a valuable point, and I do think that intellectuals are, you know, can be undermined in the movement, and I think that they're. You know, absolutely necessary. I mean, I don't mean self-aggrandizing intellectuals by any stretch of imagination. I'm talking about what I think is like Marx and Trotsky, for instance. As you were speaking, because I got on the wrong end of the stick, you know, I was to remember a Stoic maxim that reads along the line, that likes to, well, hold your breath until you go blue in the face, they're still going to keep on doing it. The counter argument, so what is to be done then? Well, don't blame them as a philosopher. And by that, what my thoughts are trying to follow the train of my thoughts is that it's necessary for intellectuals to carry the message and to be able to convince people prior to any sort of revolutionary action at all. I mean, myself, at certain stages in my life, I've been more politicised than at others, but I found myself at one stage in my life really, it's a strange feeling to acknowledge that, or feeling that I rather like lacked a voice, that I was truly, you know, unrepresented in culture and in all just across the board. Like I felt voiceless in the political sphere, I suppose. I mean, certainly don't mean in conversation. And then you know, having found Marx, and particularly your friend actually in the party in London, a member of the SWP, because I was struggling with Marx, he put me on to David Harvey and said, look, you know, David Harvey is a very great Marxist, and he'll kind of make your journey a little bit easier. I sort of found a voice, really, rather, you know, and it's very, very important. And so I think that the traditions of Trotsky, who I'm now reading, Guidance of Tim, and Marx, I'm reading Guidance rather of David Harvey on YouTube. They've clarified for me, so I know where I stand, if you know what I mean. And so now I know where I stand. I'm incapable now to be able to take a stand. And I think that's really important, especially where regarding the working class, because I am working class. I've worked on the tools for a long time. The populist working class, unfortunately, sort of right-wing, jingoistic, contagious rubbish. And it's really important to be able to literally convince people. Because on the construction side, people are talking about, you know, I remember it. So this popular intellectualism is starting to get some weight. And this guy got something to say and then sort of turned into a dickhead. Jordan Peterson, you know, populist sort of semi-right-wing intellectual. People on construction sites were discussing sort of what he'd got to say because of YouTube and stuff. So people are thinking, I believe, and it's important to be able to carry a left-wing message. You go, look, you know, okay, the guy got a few important things to say. Tidy your room up, right, have a bit of self-discipline, right, but then where's he going with it, okay? He's grabbed your attention, but he's putting you into sort of nonsense, okay, right. Sorry, I've done a sort of semi-counter...
Thanks for that, Andy.
Yeah,
cheers. I've got a couple of people on Zoom now. I've got Janet first and then Aubrey.
Yeah, thank you. Don't you think it might be a little bit dangerous treating theories of one person like it's a tendency as, you know, being quite dogmatic? And even like a theory of like permanent revolution, even though it's like essentially correct, it might not help us understand the situation. I mean, maybe we should start to use, you know, the sort of, is it the dialectical materialist method to analyse the current situation and balance it out a bit. That's me. Thank you.
Thank you, Janet. Thanks.
Aubrey? Yeah, I think I've probably been a Trotskyist before I joined the party and before I knew anything about Trotsky. In the way I noticed when I was working, I used to work, I have a colleague who's was brought up in a Stalinist tradition. His father was a prominent member of the British Communist Party. I could recognize my difference between his left-wing thinking and my left-wing thinking. And I think it raises issues about left unity, because I think that a lot of the mentality of a lot of others on the left, and it hit me on the Unite general secretary election, and the difference between those that supported Sharon Graham and those that supported other left-wing candidates. And I think that there's a Stalinist tradition that it's not just about the Communist Party, but also within the Labour Party and the trade union movement, that's about using the working class because they need working class support, they need working class votes, they need working class to be members of the unions, and they need the support. And they've got an agenda that's about taking control of a party, which is actually what Stalin did, and then from taking control of the party to taking control of the state, and that. And it's about them being in charge of a machine that supposedly got some, maybe some decent left-wing policies, but state control isn't socialist control. And I think there's a difference there between that sort of politics and a Trotskyist policy that's about the working class taking control of the situation, the members of the union taking control of their workplace and running their union, rather than trade union bureaucrats running the trade union, or about party members running the party and controlling the party, and not just a few people at the top of the party ruling the party. And I think that has repercussions for the way we approach issues. Yeah, I think united fronts are important, and we need to work alongside people in other left-wing traditions, the Labour Party, the Greens and whatever. But I do think that we need to recognise that difference. There's a difference between using the working class to put yourself in control, well, no matter how left-wing you use, and letting the working and having the working class through trade unions and whatever taking control for themselves. Thank you.
Thanks, Aubrey.
Cheers.
We do have a little bit of time if anyone else wants to come in. Tim, yeah?
Yeah, well, I think I was quite lucky in some senses when I was a younger lad, because at quite a year in the early teens, I was given Marx and Lenin from a couple of old uncles who were lefties, Marxists. But I think they should have been horror when I first read Trotsky. Absolute horror, because I now realise, of course, they were Stalinists, they were communists, and they were absolutely appalled. And I think it would have been better if they picked up something by the National Front at that time. In their eyes, I don't know, but they were appalled. And that's going to lead me on to a question, I guess. And because we, you know, James mentioned the fact that, you know, we have Trotsky being assassinated by Stalin, and we know that Trotsky was airbrushed, to use a modern term, out of Russian history. You know, as far as Stalin was concerned, he never existed, he didn't exist, and we take him out of the picture completely. We know that Trotsky's family was hunted down and killed and singled out and persecuted. And I guess that I've got to ask the question of why? Why was he so hated and so despised, particularly by Stalin? And why was he taken out in the way that it was? That's my question. Nice, easy one. And then I think I'm going to, a little bit on Janet's point, say that, look, as far as I'm concerned, I think like Aubrey, I would describe myself as a Trotskyite before I even knew who Trotsky was. Because when I read the stuff, it resonated with me from a very early age. And yet, so does Marx and so does Lenin. And so, you know, I when I found the SWP, it took me a long time to join, but I eventually joined when, for me, things seem to coalesce, things seem to come together, because it's not a dogmatic theory of just one thing. You know, we do, you know, see the United Front, we do see permanent revolution, but we do use a Marxist of historical materialism dialectics. I think it's a combination of all those things that is unique to the SWP, I would argue, because there are lots of Marxist groups, aren't there? You know, it's like throwing a stone into a pond with lots of ripples. And you can find lots of Marxist leftist groups, you know, Leninist, Marxist, all sorts of things. But for me, the SWP is the one that pulls all that together to one concentrated party. And that's why I joined the SWP.
Thank you, Tim. Oh, Right, I'm going to take Ant first, because you've not spoken yet, and then briefly Amanda, and then after that I'll ask Doug to come back.
Yeah, first of all, I imagine part of the reason that Stalin feared Trotsky so much was because Trotsky and, well, Trotsky was well respected by Lenin and vice versa, and because Stalin, even though he absolutely threw away the sort of principles of Leninism, he still liked to paint himself as a Leninist, so his biggest nightmare would have been having someone who was Lenin's sidekick sort of being able to sort of not only say Stalin, not only say that Stalin's fucking things up, but also to be able to sort of say it as somebody who sort of carried the weight of Lenin, if you like. As for the SWP Trotskyists, I'd say definitely yes. Further, was some of Trotsky's later writings might have been kind of flawed, e.g. him believing that Russia was still a degenerated workers' tape. On the other hand, by that point he was in exile. He was probably a little bit cut off from what was happening in Russia, so a lot of his analysis will have been based on second-hand information. And also, I think Tony Cliff, one of the founders of the SWP, was, I think, the first person to sort of formulate the theory of state capitalism. Tony Cliff, he did continue very much the work of Trotsky, and I'd say that we all sort of like stand on the shoulders of giants. Lenin stood on the shoulders of Marx, as did Trotsky, and I think it's true to say that Tony Cliff stood on the shoulders of Trotsky.
Can I, sorry to interrupt, can I just ask one question, Ant?
Yeah.
When did, I'm not quite sure, when did Trotsky actually write Stalin's fucking it up? I never read that. Not to agree, but I was just a condensed version.
Cheers. Thank you, Anne. Amanda.
I'll make this quick. Best, you've hit on the true function of the intellectuals. Their job is not to just come up with these intellectual concepts, but to actually break them down, explain them clearly, okay, add a little bit of showbiz, but still, and present them in a way that people can understand them clearly, without having to read through absolutely massive books. That's their job. And yes, they should actually be able to present ideas that get people on the building site, which I'm not going to say they're unintelligent people. They've just got busy doing other things. Just break it down. That's what intellectuals should be doing, in my opinion. And that's their role in the revolution. Okay.
Thanks, Amanda. And thanks, everyone, for your contributions and questions. I'm going to give Doug the opportunity to come back now for a few minutes to try and summarise some of that discussion.
Cheers, comrades. It's a really excellent discussion. And obviously, we could have meeting after meeting after meeting on this. I'm going to go through some of the things that people have said, but if I missed anything, then I do apologise for it. To go through some, the role of intellectuals, I think the person who just spoke, in a way, I think, summed it up. The role of an intellectual is to make difficult ideas easy and accessible. So the intellectuals for Chesterfield's revolutionary movement are sitting in that room and on Zoom, right? You're all the intellectuals, and the way that we would see it within the party is we would want people to constantly be contributing. That's why we have things like party council. That's why we have branch meetings every week, while we have the paper. We want different people writing in, we want different people leading things, we want people raising their own intellectual level, if you like, as being a way, not as a way of of saying, look at me, I've wrote a book or two, but as a way of saying that Marxism is easy, everyone can get it, and how we apply it depends on the circumstances in which we're in. And obviously there are going to be some people who are able to extrapolate much quicker, are able to write much quicker, are able to research quicker in a way that helps other people, and all of this is good. But we don't think that should be a select group of people who sit down there and then they send us a WhatsApp message and we go, oh, well, something's happening in Bolivia, best we should know about that, or whatever it is. That's, you know, so what we would see as being a fluid thing. And for us, the intellectual has to be useful. So it isn't just someone who can write a great book. It has to be in order to have to advance the struggle. There are lots of good books. Go to a library, there's loads of them. They're not all going to help advance revolutionary struggle. So it's about, for us, there has to be a dynamic relationship. And so what we would want is everyone trying to get in into that, and to analyse and to say, to do the meetings, blah, 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 as a way of upskilling it. And sort of the way that Tony Cliff, who was a founder member of the SWP, would argue it, is that you need to be able to get, you know, Marxism, whatever the topic is, whatever element you're looking at, can you explain it to someone you just meet on a bus in a 5-minute conversation? That's sort of the role of where we want to be. And Trotsky, when we look at Trotsky, isn't uncritically, and again we can have meetings on why Trotsky was wrong as well as who Trotsky is. And but one thing I think that we shouldn't take away from Trotsky was dynamism. He could move ideas, and that is a lesson for us, actually, and not a lesson that everyone takes. You know, after the second, when Trotsky died, was murdered by the Stalinists. His prediction was for after the Second World War was that capitalism would be destroyed, and it was, you know, it was on the brink of collapse. And instead, after the Second World War, it went for its biggest boom ever. The movements would come and sweep them away. That didn't happen, so he made a number of predictions around what would happen, about what would happen, that weren't right. And a whole number of the Trotskyists at the time just ran with it. They would invent ways to make it make sense. So, you know, Trotsky would sort of, the Second World War was going to be the war to end all wars. It was going to lead to revolution or more destruction. And so for some of the Trotskyists, they didn't accept that the Second World War had ended. And some of that might sound silly. I mean, there were other wars around the world you could point to, other bits where the British were trying to hold on to places, etc., etc. So you could point to that, but clearly bombs had stopped falling in Europe, you know, so clearly the Americans weren't just bombing the same places they'd done before. I mean, they found other places to bomb, didn't they? But you know what I mean, that the some of the Trotskyists just said, well, look, the war hasn't ended, the Second World War hasn't ended, because Trotsky said it would end in such and such a way. So Trotsky was dynamic, but I don't think Trotsky wouldn't have thought that he had a glass ball and was able to foresee the future. And so it wouldn't make sense for us to think that he did and then just go along with everything. And even the ideas around permanent revolution, we developed that idea. Our organisation, Socialist Workers Party, or the IS at the time, developed the idea of permanent revolution to make it fit, to say where we didn't fit, and you had ideas where you had a sort of, you know, sort of a middle class bourgeois military class taking over some places in a progressive manner against what the British were doing and holding on to colonies, and you know, we can have a meeting on it, but the party and Tony Cliff coined the phrase deflected permanent revolution. So you have to apply it to the circumstances. I think permanent revolution is something James said, it is still relevant. It's relevant to places like Sudan, it's relevant to places like Egypt, Palestine, etc., etc. You know, the solution isn't just winning a battle in a certain area, it has to expand. And that actually the ability for it to expand and the similarities between workers elsewhere seem ever greater. You know, loads of places have had energy crises, loads of places have had problems with inflation and hitting into living standards and all the rest of this. It's not a uniquely British thing, although our government does manage to muck it up to more of a degree than others, but it's not a unique uniquely British thing. So these things are make it relevant. But of course, you can't just say because someone wrote this 120 years ago, therefore we just take it and sort of photocopy it as being now and just change the date. You can't do that. And again, Trotsky didn't even do that. Trotsky developed theory and practice because he was a worker Bolshevik. He was part of trying to change the world around him. I think that just to come on a couple of bits, then the idea of Trotskyism and being a Trot is a slur, and it's a really interesting thing, isn't it? Because a lot of the people who would put that against us, you sort of think, well, what Trotsky wanted was global revolution where ordinary people would run the show, and if we made mistakes, there are our own mistakes, and if we flourished, we all flourished, and there would be a world without racism and sexism and all the rest of it, and the planet would have been destroyed, and that was Trotsky's idea. Now, for some people, they would see that as a term of abuse towards us. Well, I'm happy to take that. I'm happy to take that because often what they want is a world that's worse. It's a world that's worse for ordinary people, you know, and a way to destroy the entire planet. So, you know, they people can label it as a slur. But I think we should run with it. As part of saying we run, as others said, there's lots of giants within our movement, and our movement will constantly create more giants as well. You know, anyone who's at Marxism and, you know, went to the meetings with Chris Smalls and people like that, there's lots of giants within our movements today. We shouldn't think they don't exist. There's lots of ways in which we're inspired and people trying to develop theory and all the rest of it. So we can all be part of the giants club. But what we do is we look at what was useful and how it explained then to see how can it explain now. And if it can't, we don't just stick rigidly to it. We think, well, how can we get the working class, the revolutionary message from it? But I think the focal point of Trotsky, to come back to, is the idea that ordinary people can stand up and do things. So the people who don't matter most of the time, who said there'll be nothing, they'll amount to nothing, you know, they're the people that can change the world. Working class people can do it. So there's a lot more that we could go through, and I say we've got meetings, you know, get more meetings on this and have more discussions, and people write about it and talk about it, and this is all good. I just want to go back to one bit from Stalin and Stalinism. So Trotsky did understand that Stalinism was wrong. You know, he would argue that there was a river of blood between the revolution and Stalinism. So he knew that Stalinism was wrong on a whole lot of ways, but wasn't able to break from the idea of the workers of the workers' state, however deformed. Right? Okay. Now, one of the reasons that we could make that analysis, the ideas of state capitalism, wasn't just by looking at what was taking place in Russia, but because it was an ongoing thing. And you know, if you say that the Russian state is a worker state, then after the Second World War, when the tanks won in Poland and the tanks won in bits of Eastern Europe, were they all worker states too? And if they were all worker states, do all you need is a tank? Is that it? If you have a tank and you roll into somewhere, suddenly you can proclaim it as being socialist. You know, it's not how most of us would envisage it, and certainly not how Marx would envisage it. So, you know, had Trotsky lived longer, he may have made other analysis, or he may have had hard arguments back at him, and that would have been the right thing to, you know, to do it. And so, to have those arguments, say we've got to look at things in the cold light of day. And so I think, you know, again, we're part of a Trotskyist movement, but we don't see Trotsky as the messiah or something like that. You know, that isn't the way that we do it, and it's not the way we would use Marxism. So the last thing then, okay, so I'm going to finish with a quote, okay, because I think that one of the greatest things was leading the revolution in 1917. And I think that, you know, part of this, again, is Trotsky continually looking at ordinary people doing it themselves. And again, the thing we come back to time and time and time again, it's not going to be changed by the great and the good. It's not going to be changed by our betters. If we can't be bothered to change it ourselves, don't expect it to change. But we have a unique power in order to make it change, as you can see with the strikes that have been taking place all around us over the last year or so. So one of the quotes then from this book, the history of the Russian Revolution, and it is the most indubitable feature. I've said that one, but nevertheless, go ahead with it. Feature of a revolution is the direct interference of the masses in historical events. In ordinary times, the state, be it monarchical or democratic, elevates itself above the nation, and history is made by specialists in that line of business: kings, ministers, bureaucrats, parliamentarians, journalists. But at these crucial moments, when the old order becomes no longer endurable to the masses, they sweep aside their traditional representatives and create by their own interference the initial groundwork for a new regime. Now, as we've been speaking, comrades, the revolution has broken out all around you. In Chesterfield, it is taking place. People are taking to the streets. But we have to be on guard, OK? It's vital that we use, you know, Jeannie, who is the representative at the Chesterfield Soviet today, knows that the points of weakness in Chesterfield and where we have to go in order to make certain we're mobilised. So somewhere at the end of this meeting, we'll be going to the train station to make certain that the lines can stay open. And there's some of you who need to put the barricades up on the main roads to stop the forces of reaction trying to pummel through. Some of you are going to have to be the people who are there making certain that medicines and bread and food and warmth can be distributed all around. Yeah. Some of you are going to be there making certain that we spread the news to the neighbouring towns and cities that the revolution has come to Chesterfield. The revolution can come to elsewhere if only we choose to take it. So comrades, at the end of this meeting, Jeannie has your task in a little envelope. Take it. Go. We've got the revolution much further beyond Derbyshire, beyond the Midlands, and beyond everywhere else in the country. Go on, comrades. Take the task and run with it.